Hello, my name's Ben Burrell and welcome back to Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that takes an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording record by record. Thank you to everyone that has supported the podcast this week. Hello to Mick and String Bean, what a great name. Jimmy and Noel and Peter and also Leona46. I won't read any more of your email address. That's all we need to know. Thank you to you. You too can support the podcast by buying me a coffee. There's a link, as usual, in the episode description. If you reviewed the show this week and you dropped in a little subtle Bob Dylan reference, then good work. I will give you a name check at the end of this episode. But let's not waste any more time. Let's get straight back into this classic album and have a look at a couple more tracks from it and also the sonic identity of the record too. This is part number 4 on Highway 61 Revisited.
Oh, how it just pointed.
Listening to this album now has reminded me just how compact and cohesive it is. It isn't lengthy like its successor, and it knows what it wants to be, unlike its predecessor. Whilst for me, the record never quite has the sonic intrigue of Blonde on Blonde, I mean, that sound is almost undefinable. It's murky, it's thin, and it's wild, and it's mercury, as it's been described. This is a much cleaner affair. Whereas I've always seen Blonde on Blonde as a nighttime album in the haze of the midnight hour, this feels like the early evening. Things are just starting to get going. So while the Sonics might not be as advanced as the next record, at the time this was as far as Bob had gone. He'd fully shared the acoustic sound, and this rock and roll phase was now in full swing. It feels like it wasn't too far away from, say, Willie Dixon and Backdoor Man. But this is not a parody. This is Dylan's rock and roll, and it's very distinctive. For a start, we have that honky-tonk barrel piano sound I've mentioned many, many times before. Bob stuck metal thumbtacks into the felt pads on the hammers in the piano to get that sound, which we now know as a tack piano. It wasn't Dylan's invention, but it serves the album really, really well. Notice the shift in style from a normal piano to a tack piano. This gives all the piano parts a clattering thud. It was like Dylan was looking to create a wall of sound to drape behind the tunes. It looks like he was continuing that mantra from the Newport Folk Festival to play it fucking loud. This sound also adds a nice texture to the songs. That piano adds almost additional percussion and a bit of grit to the tunes. It's a harsher sound than the regular run-of-the-mill piano and suits this new rock and roll direction perfectly. Also, the organ does a similar job. As we know, Al Cooper didn't really have a clue about how to play the instrument, and its slightly ramshackle playing adds to that feeling. Not to mention, its sound is dialed up to 10, something the guitars often aren't. Whilst they are very straightforward and clean-cut, they never sound anything but big. That organ, though, acts as a tearaway. It offers something different. In fact, as I mentioned on previous episodes, the guitars are fairly conservative. This, of course, could be brought on by the fact that we're listening to this album in a world where punk and metal and grunge and a whole host of other genres exist, but they sound tame to a degree. There's no distortion in their sound. It's all fairly safe. I suspect if Bob had recorded this album towards the end of the decade, some Revolution-style fuzz might have made it in. This doesn't mean the guitars aren't a highlight here. What they lack in fuzz, they more than make up in being a bedrock for each song. On the opener, they sound huge, for example. They add weight to that track. They stride with each strum, like a battleship moving slowly and purposefully with an unstoppable pace. Elsewhere, they're quite light, on Queen Jane and It Takes a Lot to Laugh, for example. The only times they really show off is with a reckless acoustic guitar on Tombstone Blues, and of course the title track's Sly Guitar.
Oh, God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, man, you must be putting me on.
The only time we can really call the guitars grandiose is on album Closer, as Charlie McCoy gives us a masterclass in guitar fills.
Upon Noah's great rainbow, she spends her time peeking into Desolation Row.
While the guitars are obviously important to the majority of Dylan's songs here, more often than not, it's other instruments that get the limelight. Perhaps this was a conscious decision. For many years, whole albums would just be a guitar and occasionally the harmonica. We all have that image of a young Dylan clutching his guitar on an empty stage with nothing else for company. Here, though, it couldn't be more different. As we know, Bob had spent the better part of the previous two albums killing that image off, so here to revert back to a guitar-focused sound would have been a step in the wrong direction. It's a new sound that would serve Bob well. Those unique piano and organ parts make for very focused sonics. It's not completely unique, but it does give the album an identity. All the albums from Dylan up until this point felt like another chapter of the same story. This, however, feels like a self-contained universe. It's focused and it has a personality. The songs sound similar, but they don't sound the same. And the lyrics also have lots in common too. And due to the fact it's 9 tracks of rock and roll, it means we never really deviate from the album's mantra. It's possibly Dylan's most concise record. It's like a quick punch of rock and roll, which obviously suits the song's themes perfectly. This, along with Blonde on Blonde, are Dylan's most complete records in terms of their sonic identity, in my opinion. It would also appear that even songs that were for all intents and purposes good tracks wouldn't make it onto the final LP because they didn't fit. Take Sitting on a Barbed Wire Fence, for example. It's a great listen and it feels like it more than meets the quality control standards of the record, but the sound just isn't in the Highway 61 Revisited universe. Am I temperature rising? Just like It Takes a Lot to Laugh, It Takes a Train to Cry, it's a bluesy song, but here it's almost too far over the line. It's too bluesy for this non-bluesy album. Also, the fact that Positively 4th Street wasn't included feels like this record is an album where the fat was trimmed. Not only that, though, there were some responsible decisions being made too. Judging by the cutting-edge bootleg tapes, the best songs were chosen for the final album. Of course, it's all subjective, and there's some great versions that failed to materialise on the finished product, but unlike, say, Blood on the Tracks, you don't feel like there's some gems that have been left off. When you listen to the bootleg of that album, More Blood, More Tracks, there's some songs that you might have wished would have been on the final track listing. Personally, I love the New York sessions from that period. But here, that never feels like it's the case. Even, as we've looked at before, the type of song chosen feels right. The decision, for example, to have a slower-paced version of It Takes a Lot to Laugh, It Takes a Train to Cry, serves the overall pacing of the album really well. If we had to class something as filler on this record, then I guess we might point the finger at a couple of songs. But really, it's like trying to work out the most religious pope. However, a quick look at an online poll suggests that From a Buick 6 is the least favourite song on the record, which I can sort of see. Then comes the album's title track, which I can see even more. It's a fine 3.5 minutes, but I couldn't call it the album's peak. It's by no means a dud, though. That Sly guitar is definitely an album highlight. It just sounds so different to a lot of other Sly guitar. It has an electric feel to it. It pings rather than slides, almost like a shock rather than the usual warmer Sly guitar sound. Well, Abe said, where do you want this killing done? God settled on Highway 61. Despite just talking about the album's strong identity, this song is possibly the least Highway 61 sounding track. That recognisable piano and organ aren't present here at all. However, there is some great electric piano work, just like we had on Ballad of a Thin Man. There's also a driving drum line, just like the one on Tombstone Blues, but apart from that, it's pretty different. I love that Bob chooses the title track as the one that stands out sonically. Along with the slide guitar, there's a slide whistle, which is the song's standout instrument. Tony Glover, in the liner notes to Live 1966, says it was brought in by Sam Lay, who was working on the album's tracks. But others say that Al Cooper was the owner, and it was apparently used to police the sessions. Apparently, he later suggested to Dylan that he used the whistle in the song instead of his usual harmonica. And while this sound does create a deviation from the album's sonics, it still manages to keep within that sonic universe. That whistle adds to that feeling of mania present elsewhere on the record, and it's kind of goofy and hysterical, but in a sort of warped way. It's like a giggling fit in the haze of smoke and pills. It creates an almost ironic party feeling, especially as its first use is followed by the sobering lyrics of God said to Abraham, kill me a son. To Abraham, kill me a son. The lyrics elsewhere add to this atmosphere too, as Bob sings, well, Mac the Finger said to Louis the King, I've got 40 red, white and blue shoestrings and 1,000 telephones that don't ring. These lines not only have a touch of that madness present elsewhere on the album, but also note that use of a historical figure, another record staple. The song has five stanzas. In each stanza, a character has an issue that is ultimately resolved on or by going to Highway 61. There's a classic format to this song. It's almost quite traditional. Everything resorts back to a particular place or thing. Just like in Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat, for example, we keep going back to the song's title. Everything reverts back to it. It's almost a reoccurring punchline. The highway itself seems to represent a place where there's no rules. It's like a Wild West. Things can happen there that wouldn't be able to take place in the real world. On the first verse, God tells Abraham that he can kill his son Isaac out on Highway 61. This is obviously a reference to the Bible story where Abraham begins to comply, but a messenger from God interrupts him. Abraham then sees a ram and sacrifices that instead of his son, and God is satisfied that he is loyal. However, here it appears that Abraham's son does get murdered, as the last we hear from God is saying, "You can do it out on Highway 61. That's it. There's no happy ending." Which follows another album theme on this record of the twisted fairy tale. Just like those fairy tales from Desolation Row and the lines of a hollow upper class, defeat is being snatched from the jaws of victory in this song. In the next verse, Georgia Sam, who appears to be in a bad way with a bloody nose, is almost sentenced to Highway 61 by someone called Howard. There's evidence to suggest that Howard is Howard Smith, the chairman of the House Rules Committee during Lyndon Johnson's presidency. He tried to kill the Civil Rights Act of 1964 by introducing an amendment to include women under its provisions. Ironically, this actually helps the measure pass. So it would appear that Howard is all for segregation, which becomes even more interesting when we find out that Georgia Sam is black. For a start, Georgia played a major role as a state in the civil rights movement, which instantly gives us a civil rights feeling. Plus, the name Georgia Sam feels like a name given to a marginalised member of society. This is not a full name. He doesn't appear to have a last name. It's more like he's Sam, he's from Georgia. We'll call him Georgia Sam. Most interestingly, though, is that Georgia Sam was the recording pseudonym for blues artist and Dylan hero Blind Willie McTell, who, of course, was also black. Sam is in a bit of a state by all accounts and desperate for help, whilst Howard, almost threateningly with that gun, is telling him Highway 61 is the place to find safety, knowing full well that it isn't. The next verse follows the same format as the first two, with the characters Mac the Knife and Louis the King. The King helps the other character get rid of 40 red, white and blue shoestrings and 1,000 telephones that don't ring, which, as I mentioned, echoes that madness found elsewhere on the record, and also is a dig once again at high society. The colour choices here obviously reflect the American flag with the red, white and blue shoestrings, and it feels like it's highlighting the worst bits of American society that aren't working with those telephone lines. Whilst just like in previous verses, Louis the King, the one in power, is sending someone clearly in need to Highway 61, even though it doesn't seem to be a good place to go. Again, Dylan is showing disdain for the ruling class.
Well, Mac the Finger said to Louis the King, "I got 40 red, white, blue shoestrings and 1,000 telephones that don't ring. Do you know where I can get rid of these things?" And Louis the King said, "Let me think for a minute, son."
We then have a verse that seems to reference Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. It also contains a daughter who says that things aren't right, my face is too white. She is looking for answers with her father as she ventures to Highway 61 to find her mother, who is off with the seventh son, which in folklore is the name for someone with special powers, almost like the mother has abandoned these two characters in their time of need and now they're looking for her. Finally, the last verse concentrates on a gambler who is looking to create the next war. He finds someone who is able to facilitate that, and guess where it can be done? You're right, Highway 61. The whole song, or road, feels like it's leading us through the drama of man, from Abraham and Isaac in the book of Genesis right through to the eventual commercialization of America and then to nuclear war. The highway is obviously an important concept on the record. Here it represents the journey of life. It's changing and it's full of pitfalls and corrupt power. And I think that's why it's become the album's title track. Dylan's on a changing journey himself. It's a shift to something new, a process which is like travelling down a long road. The road itself does actually exist. The actual Highway 61 is real. It's a major American highway which connected Bob's birthplace of Duluth, Minnesota, to southern cities famed for their musical heritage, including St. Louis and Memphis and New Orleans. And that also feels significant. Highway 61 not only represents Bob's journey from his birthplace to new musical frontiers, but the revisited part implies a change. On the face of it, it could be a dreary covers album title. Here I am covering some classic American tunes from St. Louis or New Orleans, but the revisited part comes to mean something different. It's not revisiting the same old songs, it's revisiting them with a new approach, a fresh take. Sure, Dylan is influenced by these old blues songs, but here he's gone electric. This is Dylan revisiting this old, well-worn style and changing it. And speaking of revisiting, track 6, Queen Jane Approximately, revisits the subject matter from the first track. However, this time, it's a little bit different.
When your mother sends back all your invitations.
Just as it was in Like a Rolling Stone, Bob is singing about a member of high society who is at odds with their world. The opening verse feels like we're hearing about a young member of the aristocracy who is unstable. Bob sings, "When your mother sends back all your invitations and your father to your sister, he explains." Which sounds like our Queen Jane can't leave the house. She can't even talk to her sister, as her father has to do that for her. Bob continues telling us she's tired of herself and all her creations. Which maybe gives us a reason why she won't leave her home. Depression has taken hold. In the final lines of the verse, Dylan offers an outlet for her grief, singing, "Won't you come and see me, Queen Jane?"
Won't you come see me, Queen Jane?
The format from this verse continues throughout the song as we hear about a part of Queen Jane's life that has gone awry in every verse. In the second verse, we hear her children resenting her. In the third, we hear about the clowns she's commissioned that no longer make her laugh. The fourth concerns plastic advisors or yes men not helping our queen. Before, in the final verse, we hear Dylan sing, "Now when all the bandits that you turn your other cheek to all lay down their bandanas and complain." Which is a great couple of lines. Our queen, who's been guilty of a little corruption, is now being surrounded on all sides, including the bandits she previously paid off.
Now when all of the bandits that you turn your other cheek to
feels like our narrator is trying to convince her to run away from all of this with every verse. He's stating, this is wrong and that's wrong, so why not come and see me? Why not come and be with me? Those final lines about the bandits act as a last straw. It would appear our queen's lost control. Dylan, though, offers some refuge. Whereas with Like a Rolling Stone, he was sentencing this member of the elite who'd got herself carried away with her own grandiose shortcomings, here, though, Bob is offering an olive branch. Perhaps time has passed, and after the whirlwind of the opening song and passing judgment, Bob has been lenient with the sentence. The last line summed the whole song up for me. Queen Jane appears to be in this lifestyle where everyone wants a piece of her, but if she was to come into Dylan's world, which for me represents the real world, the world most of us live in, then she would have somebody she doesn't need to speak to. An easier life, for example, a life where it's not all questions and decisions. Not for the first time on this album, Dylan is singing about escape, which I think it's fair to say matches his own situation and something that is highlighted on the final line of track 8 as he sings, "I'm going back to New York City, I do believe I've had enough." This is also found on It Takes a Lot to Laugh, It Takes a Train to Cry's Journey to a New Life, and that line from a Buick 6 about needing to unload his head, and that Wild West off-limits zone of Highway 61. This all again feeds into the main themes of the album, and it's something that ultimately ends on the final track, Desolation Row. There is some suggestion that the Queen Jane here is Joan Baez, and there is of course similarity in the names Jane and Joan, and Dylan and Baez's reputations as the king and queen of folk music and the souring of their relationship sort of fits into the song, but for me it's just a little too easy. The whole Joan and Jane thing feels a little bit too obvious to be fun and a little bit too basic to be a veiled attempt at covering her identity. The other theory of this song being about drug withdrawal feels more suited, as the character in the song has a bored, restless demeanour and she's looking for a way out. But again, it does feel quite tenuous. Just like with Like a Rolling Stone, this for me feels more like a self-contained story and that's it. As far as the sonics of the song are concerned, it's one of the record's more poppy conservative tracks. It's actually quite mildly paced for this album, and as is a staple for Bob, the recording is far from perfect. The guitars clash with the piano and organ parts, leading us to assume that the guitar was out of tune. Let's listen to that slight clash on the song's chorus.
Won't you come see me, Queen Jane?
Yes, that's right, on an album that redefined an icon's career, they didn't bother to check the guitar tuning. Could you imagine that happening today with a contemporary record from, say, Noel Gallagher or the Arctic Monkeys or 1975 or anyone? And that's not a criticism, by the way. It's actually refreshing to hear stuff like this. Music has become exact and auto-tuned. Those little moments of reality have all but been airbrushed out.
To convince you of your pain.
As for the makeup of the song, it's the usual Highway 61 story. That clunking barrel-type piano is in one ear whilst the organ is in the other. The guitars are clean and bright, and there's a tambourine on the drum line that is in time with the snare hits. In fact, for this album, it's actually quite straight. Bloomfield isn't allowed to cut loose, Cooper's organ is very by the book for once, and there's nothing in particular out of the ordinary like on Tombstone Blues or Ballad of a Thin Man. Whilst I do like this song, it's far from my favourite on the album. I mean, it does a good job of ticking the pop song box, it's got a big melody, for example, but it's not my go-to tune. I know I'm possibly in the minority with this. There is, however, some interesting other takes of this song. There's a more stripped-back sound on the Cutting Edge box set that reminds me of the compartmentalised sound of Positively 4th Street.
Won't you come and see me, Queen Jay?
There's also another version of this song that makes use of a glockenspiel, which reminds me of the Velvet Underground's Sunday Morning.
Won't you come see me?
If this version had made it on the album, it might have brought a nice touch of shade to a big, gleaming rock album, but that might also be the reason why we don't get it. Once again, it would have interrupted the DNA of the record. These versions don't adhere to the album's character of big, poppy, concise songs. There's a more than meandering feeling to these cuts that just would have stood out too much on the final album, ruining that atmosphere I mentioned before. And that very identity might make this one of Dylan's best albums. But is it his best album full stop? That's something we look at next time. That is it for this episode. As usual, thanks for listening and thank you to everyone that has written a review of the podcast. I know I do bang on about this, but it really does help with the Apple Podcast app. They really do value reviews and ratings. So if you do like the show, then please give us a review and a good rating too. And if you can slip in a Bob Dylan reference, then that's even better. Some people have done that. Hi to Lyndon, who called me the Robert Shelton of the podcasting world. Now, Robert Shelton is a music critic that is a famous Bob Dylan music critic. I hope that's who he's talking about. Either him or it's the bloke that was in charge of the Ku Klux Klan for a while. Hopefully the former, as I say. But thank you for that. Hi to Wendy, who did like a review made up of like a line of lyrics, which was great. And the final lyric is all about when I'm going to review Under the Red Sky, which I think is an episode we're all looking forward to. Hi to Neil as well. And hi to Leon. Nice reference to Like a Rolling Stone in yours. Some of the references are quite long-winded, so I won't go into them here. But thank you. If you can review the show, then please take 5 minutes out of your day to do that now. It helps us no end. Next time, we are having a look at Highway 61 Revisited once again. It's the final look at this album, and it's the final episode of this season. So join me then, please. In the meantime, thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next time.